Good afternoon. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, specifically Section 24-4-103 of Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is Tuesday, July 7th, 2015. The time is 2:02. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room on the third floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. I'm Secretary of State Wayne Williams, and I am convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on June 10th, 2015. We have a few people here from our office who'll be assisting in the process. We have, and if you can wave your hand so people know who you are, Stephanie Mann, Legal Analyst, Elections Division. Melissa Polk, Legal Analyst, Elections Division. Andrea Geiger, Department Rulemaking Manager, Administration Division. And Matthew Grove, Assistant Solicitor General. Also with us is our Deputy for Elections, Judge Choate, and there are a few other Secretary of State staff in various other locations around. Purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. As stated in the notice, the purpose of the rulemaking is to consider rule revisions necessary to implement legislation, clarify and simplify the rules, remove language duplicative of statute, and ensure consistency with department rulemaking standards. Secretary of State released a preliminary draft of proposed rules with a notice of rulemaking on July 1st, 2015. Revised proposed draft rules were made available to the public. Both drafts are available on the office website. Copies of the notice of rulemaking, revised draft statement of basis, and the revised draft rules are available on the table at the back of the room. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. This meeting is audio recorded and all comments become a part of the official legal record. This hearing is also being broadcast over the internet. For anyone who wishes to testify at this hearing, there are sign-up sheets on the table at the back of the room, and some of them are already up here as well. In order to testify, you do need to sign up, and we ask that you do that. For the record, our office has also received a number of written comments on the proposed rules, which we also consider and which are part of the official record. All comments received become a part of that record. They are all actually posted online. As we get them in, we publish additional ones online for other people to review. At this time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data, views, or arguments or amendments on amendments to the election rules in writing and, if desired, orally. So today, if you've not submitted written comments, you are welcome to do that as well. You can also submit comments at the podium, and this hearing is scheduled to conclude by 4 p.m. However, it is not necessary for us to go all the way till 4. And so if someone has already made the comment that you wish to make and you simply wish to acknowledge your agreement with something that has come before, please feel free to say that. If testimony becomes repetitive otherwise strays from the purpose of this rulemaking, you may be asked to come back on point. I would ask that you respect the process. And with that, are there any questions before we begin? Let me ask this, and see, there's several people signed up. Is there anyone who is under a time constraint where they need to go immediately? Not seeing that, I will go ahead and do it. Does anyone have a preference where they want to go first? Not seeing any, I will go in order of the sign-up list, if that's okay. So our first is Senator Laura J. Woods. Thank you, Senator, for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. My statement today is directed to just one single proposed rule change, and it's the proposed amendment to Rule 16.2.1, Parent C, concerning electronic transmission. This rule change contradicts both the legislative intent of the 2006 and 2011 legislation on this matter, which established statutory authority for electronic transmission of a ballot in very limited circumstances as well as the expressed intent of the 70th General Assembly in 2015, of which I am a member, when similar language allowing an expansion of internet voting was deleted from House Bill 151130. I believe it's clearly an inappropriate use of Secretary of State rulemaking authority to attempt an expansion of internet voting by way of a definition never contemplated by the authors of the legislation being cited as the basis for the change. I know whereof I speak regarding the floor debates and amendments made to House Bill 1130 in the 2015 session of the legislature, language that would have allowed the expansion of internet voting along the lines permitted by this proposed rule change was removed from the bill. It was expressly rejected before the bill was passed. Thus, I'm here to object not only to the rule change proposed in the draft rule 16.2.1 Pren C, but I also strenuously object to the spirit of administrative overreach embodied in this proposed rule, a disappointing level of overreach that reminds us of the arrogance that federal agencies use, ignoring the will of Congress by writing rules based on their own notions of public policy, not laws enacted by the elected representatives of the people. In some places, it's called not overreach, but an abuse of power. I also note that the statement submitted to the Secretary of State by Colorado Common Cause agrees with this view. Quote, the proposed rule would controvert both the letter and the spirit of the statute as written, creating a new class of email voters. The entire rule, 16.2.1 paren C, should be rejected and the subject of electronic transmission given much more extensive study and evaluation by the legislature and by election security experts before any significant changes are attempted in rulemaking. And I think just to add to that, I would point to the recent hack into the federal government's database and Sony's data. None of that is secure. So those are some of our concerns. Thank you.
Senator, are you willing to respond to questions?
Perhaps.
Okay. Are there questions from other members of the panel first? Okay. I do have one. 1130 that you referred to dealt with a municipal election bill in which the signatures are not verified. Is that correct?
It dealt with a municipal election bill, yes.
Okay. In which signatures are not required to be verified.
That's correct, my understanding.
Okay. And then the other question I have for you is, with respect to 1.8, 1-8.3-113A, are you aware of...
Can you give me the number again,
sure.
Mr. Secretary?
It is 1-8.3-113. So
okay.
It's the statute that's cited in the rule you're referring to.
Yes.
Specifically provides for rules to be promulgated by the Secretary of State. Are there alternative rules that you believe should be submitted? And I'm not asking you to do it on the spot, but if you wish to submit anything prior to our deadline of written comments, which is next what? So the records are going to be kept up until next Tuesday. So if there is an alternative wording you would wish to submit, we'd invite you to do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank
I appreciate
you very
it.
Much.
Margit Johansson. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
My name is Margit Johansson. I'm from Boulder, Colorado, and I am with Coloradans for Voting Integrity. I'm interested in two of the UOCAVA related rules. The first is Rule 16.2.1, bracket C, which concerns a UOCAVA elector's judicious use of return of voted ballots by email or fax. It defines the situations when mail is, quote, not feasible, as circumstances where the elector believes the timely return of his or her ballot by mail is not certain. This reliance on an elector's belief is problematic, given that the return of voted ballots by email or fax, and fax these days is usually combined with email, is insecure, so can easily be used to change or create votes with no way to check vote validity. A voter's decision to use email returns, then, is a serious choice. How much has an elector been educated as to the effectiveness of the provisions of the 2009 MOVE Act to improve timely return of mail ballots? And what MOVE provisions, M-O-V-E, Act provisions, for expedited mail returns has been advertised and provided for by the Secretary of State? What instructions do UOCAVA electors receive advising swift return of mail ballots and use of expedited mail? Many military and overseas citizens have bad memories of poor mail delivery of ballots which predate 2009, and these memories could linger without knowledge of improved voting conditions. And of course, since email voting does allow for the creation of bogus votes, those people who do things like that probably are not too concerned with feasibility issues. Election officials should work with government agencies to find out about the rare cessation of mail deliveries and inform voters when there is a real absence of a mail alternative, rather than let voters make unnecessary use of insecure email fax returns. Okay, the second rule is 16.2.8. It defines internet voting as only web-based voting to the exclusion of email fax returns. This has, I think, the effect of making email and fax seem less of a threat to election integrity than so-called real internet voting. Scientists concerned with internet voting, on the other hand, routinely include email fax in the definition of internet voting, presumably on the grounds that both web-based voting and return of voted ballots by email make use of the internet in the voting process. For example, election experts and computer scientists Douglas Jones and Barbara Simons, in their excellent book, Broken Ballots, more than once include both web-based and email returns in their definition of internet voting. On page 269, they write, quote, "Internet voting, whether web-based or via email, involves having a computer, parenthesis client, typically that of the voter, communicate via the internet with a server," end quote. Also, the cogent article on internet voting on Verified Voting's website says, both email voted ballots and transmitting them through a web portal are forms of internet voting. We wonder about the origins of this rule, since it is not science-based. Has some special interest fact denier put this forward, be it a political party, a vendor, or other entity? In any case, it doesn't bring the Secretary closer to fulfilling his legislative mandate as recorded in CRS 11107, Powers and Duties of Secretary of State, parenthesis 5. The provision of this section are enacted pursuant to section 11 of Article 7 of the State Constitution to secure the purity of elections and to guard against the abuses of the elective franchise. That's it.
Are there questions? I do have one. I think you raised the issue that you don't want, and if I've mistakenly said something, please let me know. Who do you believe should make the determination as to whether a service member's return is proper under the provisions of 1.8.3-113?
Well, it's really hard to know, but you want to make sure that if they are going to make the decision, the voters themselves, that they have, they're up to date on what's been changing. And I don't know that they have that, you know, and they also might just, they're, if they aren't given guidance, they should be getting their ballots in quickly. They could just, you know, goof off, or something legitimate could come in the middle. So I'm not sure. But the other option is that there probably aren't too many circumstances these days where, with the length of time that you have to vote and so forth, that it's really going to be necessary to use the email option. Research could be done to see where the snags are. That's one thing. And as I mentioned, you know, sometimes there's a weather situation or something rather extreme where mail actually is suspended. And I think that could be determined before any election. The intelligence could be passed around so you know that there is a choice to be made. And it could be kind of a give and take between the voters and election officials and the government, maybe, you know, postal service and so forth, about where there's a situation extreme enough to use email, because it's serious to use email. You're not, the voter doesn't know at this point, I don't think, that yes, they're being given the chance to vote, wonderful, but they're also being given the chance to have their vote changed, have other votes added that are, could influence the return, the results of an election. So they may make a casual decision where it's really worth something to them to avoid email return of ballots when possible.
So, and if I missed what, who should be that final arbiter? Should it be the voter or should it be a government bureaucrat?
I didn't come to any statement.
Okay, that's fine then. I just wanted to, thank you.
Okay, back and forth, the cooperation of gathering information.
Okay. Stan Martin, Adams County Clerk and Recorder. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Secretary. Stan Martin, Adams County Clerk and Recorder. Thanks for the opportunity to comment on the draft rules. I appreciate your review of the ESRC's initial comments and also appreciate the detailed response released yesterday to those comments.
If I can interject there, yeah, for those who may not be aware of what we did. In the past, rulemaking has been a one-directional dialogue in which people provided input, but there was really no response from the office except the adoption or rejection of certain changes. We are trying to enhance that dialogue by at least explaining briefly, they're not very long explanations, whether what we did with the comments and what changes, if any, were made. And so we're trying to enhance that rulemaking process and have a more open dialogue on it. And so that's on our website available for anyone to look at. And we didn't include every comment where they were repetitive, but we at least wanted to at least give some dialogue. So I appreciate you highlighting that.
Yeah, you're welcome. So with regard to the most recent rule draft, first, I agree with the comments submitted by the ESRC on Monday. Second, I would like to provide comments specific to proposed Rule 7.2.6 regarding third-party delivery and also Rule 7.7.1 regarding the missing signature cure process. With respect to proposed Rule 7.2.6, I strongly support investigation of ballot tampering and voter intimidation, but the draft rule as written is too vague and provides no direction to clerks. If the intent is to assist with enforcement, if there are allegations of tampering, as stated in the justification, please provide clerks guidance on what information should be captured or retained when a voter completes this section of the envelope. Must a clerk review every ballot envelope to see if this section is completed? is the information to be turned over to the SOS or DA for investigation. Are ballots rejected until after investigation if more than 10 are returned by a third party? The rule as currently drafted is unforeseeable by clerks and will lead to voter confusion, so I ask that if the Secretary adopts the rule as proposed, please provide specificity regarding what happens after the ballot envelope is received. In regards to proposed Rule 7.7.1, first, thank you for clarifying that ballots with missing signatures aren't investigated by the DA. I believe strongly that many voters who simply forget to sign their ballots would be intimidated when contacted by the DA, and the change you have made to the proposal eliminates that requirement. However, the current proposal still requires voters to provide a copy of their ID when curing a missing signature. Given that we can verify a voter's identity through signature verification once they provide the missing signature, requiring an actual photocopy of the ID is unnecessary. Further, I am concerned that many voters will not have easy access to copy machine and won't send in an ID. If that happens, as clerk, will I be required to reject a ballot on a technicality even though I have verified the voter's identity through signature verification? Therefore, I ask that you consider removing the ID copy requirement from a draft rule. And that's it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Clerk Martin. Are there questions? Let me check one thing. And just so you're aware, a smartphone picture also works as a copy of an ID. So there are, I recognize most people may not have a copier in their house, but many people do have access to a smartphone, so there are a number of different ways in which, as you're assisting your voters who might have that requirement, that we can help them do that. And
sure,
as I walked my daughter through the process after her signature was disqualified in the last election.
Let me ask you this. Was her signature disqualified for missing signature or a discrepancy?
Discrepant.
So I want to make sure that we define the difference between a missing signature and a signature discrepancy here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Lenny Nunez, Common Cause. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. My name is Elena Nunez. I'm the Executive Director of Colorado Common Cause. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that works for open and accountable government. I have several comments on the rules. First, on the rules relating to the background check requirement, and I'll submit all of this in writing as well so you all have it, but rules 2.13.1b, 6.4.1, and 6.5. We do oppose striking the background check requirement from the rules for those who are handling voter registrations or doing anything related to SCORE. We understand from the rationale for review of the initial comments that this is because the background check is currently required as part of the SCORE user agreement. But our experience from the Election Watcher Advisory Group is that there is a lot of concern about personal information. And because of that concern, we think it's important that the background check remain in rule so it's clear that that is a requirement that cannot be changed without going through a formal rulemaking process. On Rule 7.11.2b, we support the adoption of this rule. We believe that if access to SCORE is available, that giving the option to a voter to cast a regular ballot is always preferable. So we appreciate the department's guidance on this rule and would encourage its adoption. 7.2.6, we oppose the adoption of this rule. We think it's problematic to add an additional requirement that a voter identify who they're handling their giving their ballot to, and we don't think that it's justified by the statute. The statute simply talks about the limitation on the number of ballots that can be returned. So our reading is that to provide this information would be optional, but that may provide confusion to voters when they look at the envelope and think that they have to provide that information. So we would urge the Secretary to reject this rule. On Rule 7.7.1, I'll just say that we share the concerns raised by Clerk Martin. We think that it would be problematic to have any of those signature missing ballots be marked as ID deficient as well and have them provide a copy of their ID. So we would encourage the Secretary to reject that rule. On Rule 16.2.8, we appreciate the effort of the Secretary of State's office to define internet voting. We share the concerns raised by some of the other witnesses that this definition does not track with commonly understood definitions of internet voting. And in fact, if you look at the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, they issued a report in 2011, and in their definition of internet voting, it includes not only the situations that are described in the proposed rule, but also when a marked ballot is transmitted by email or fax. And that is consistent, I think, with the common understanding of what internet voting is. So we don't think that if there's a definition to be adopted, it can be adopted without recognizing that even what's allowed currently is internet voting and that statute allows it in limited circumstances. So we think that that definition should be reworked. And then we continue to oppose Rule 16.2.1c. We think that feasible, as intended by the legislature, is intended to be a very limiting factor for circumstances when access to returning a ballot by a more secure method, that is by mail, are not available and the voter cannot get their ballot back in time to have it counted. So if there is going to be a definition of feasibility, we think it should be tied to returning your ballot in a timely manner where it can be cast. And then finally, on Rule 23.1, we support the creation of a commission. We think it's important to bring together stakeholders to talk about elections processes and really appreciate the commitment of this office to doing so and support that rule as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Nunez? Let me ask what I asked one of the other, earlier ones. Who should have the final decision as to whether that service member's ballot meets the definition that's set forth in statute? Should it be the government bureaucrat or should it be that service member?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I would just say that I think to the extent that the office promulgates rules to define what feasible is, it's important that it be limited and that it be clear that it's when you can't otherwise cast a ballot. And given that a voter who chooses to return their ballot by a not secure method is exposing their ballot to the possibility of it being hacked or, you know, not representing their choices, that we should be very careful about making sure that voters have the information they need to make that choice. So if there is going to be a rule, and certainly any guidance that this office puts out, it should be very clear about the risks and also that it's not intended to be just a convenience, that it's for circumstances when it's not otherwise a possibility to vote.
Okay. Thank you, and I look forward to receiving your comments. And again, as I mentioned to one of the prior commenters, if you've got specific suggestions for wording, we always welcome those. Thank you very much.
Will do. Thank you.
Amber McReynolds, Denver County Elections. Thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary. Thanks for taking comments today. I'm Amber McReynolds. I'm the Director of Elections for Denver, and I'm also the co-chair of the ESRC committee. So thank you for the detailed response on the initial comments. We will be submitting additional comments after today for a few of the technical items that we still have concerns about. First, I wanted to go over Rule 4.3.3. This was added, I think, after the initial draft of rules. This actually, we believe it incorrectly points to a statute that doesn't apply to nonpartisan elections. It's saying that the canvas board should be appointed under the partisan structure that's in Title I, and we believe that it should actually be 110-202, and it's the members would be appointed according to the IGA or the government agreements that are set forth for the participating entities. Putting it under a partisan structure isn't appropriate for a coordinated or nonpartisan election. Some counties obviously use their partisan canvas boards as part of the coordinated election structure for canvas boards, but shifting the power of appointing those folks away from the actual entities that are participating in a nonpartisan election or unaffiliated members of canvas boards is we believe, problematic. The next rule, 7.2.6, the counties continue to have concerns about the way that this rule is currently structured. I believe that most counties felt it was fine and appropriate to have a warning on the envelope about dropping off more than 10 ballots, but this addition of having additional line for a name and an address takes up additional space that frankly isn't available, especially in counties that are maybe bilingual. So we would encourage the office to revisit 7.2.6 specifically. And I agree with Clerk Martin's comments, and he summarized, I think, what ESRC has talked about with voter confusion, what the process is post this being filled out. We have enough issues with getting people to sign in the appropriate space, and now by adding another line in space, I think we're creating some confusion for voters. 7.1, Clerk Martin summarized the issues that ESRC has talked about. This is an addition to what currently exists in terms of the process for missing signature and how that gets reviewed. And so we would echo those same comments by Clerk Martin, and we will submit those comments in our written comments as well. 7.11.3, ESRC wants to suggest a slight change to this rule. So instead of election official, make it election judge. And the reason for that is that a lot of counties have operational centers where judges can call into. We have full-time staff or SCORE experts, if you will, that might be helping the field, and they may need to have SCORE and web SCORE open to sufficiently help that. Not that they're processing voters, but maybe they're answering training questions, operational questions, or trying to determine what the issue may be with a voter's record. And so, you know, we think in a limited way that should be allowed within each office, and maybe just limit it to election judges that are specifically working in the field to not have simultaneous sessions open. 16.2.1C, sort of in response to some of the comments that have been talked about today, we as a group talked about access and integrity and a balance of the two. We feel that the rule does strike a balance for access as well as integrity of the election. ESRC, and I think most counties, and I know I certainly would agree that the determining whether or not it's feasible to return a ballot would be on the voter to make that determination. And I think based on some of the other comments made today, a ballot mailed through the post office or through USPS or FedEx or any of the other methods can be intercepted or hacked in any way as well. I mean, if it gets stuck in the equipment at the post office facility, or a recent example that we just experienced in Denver, somebody's ballot that was in a FedEx package was held up at Customs for 3 weeks, and we finally were able to get it from them a couple days before the election. But if the voter hadn't contacted us to make sure that we got it, and you know, we were able to sort of locate it and help facilitate that, and I don't know how many times that probably happens in a large election. In addition to that, I have recent experience working on this issue nationally. And as I've learned more about sort of military and service members, I mean, there's sailors that can be submerged for 60 days at a time. So it is absolutely possible that voters would not be able to use the mail stream or use another method. And it may not be feasible, either from a cost perspective or from just sheer access. And it seems to us that it's important for voters that are serving our country or serving the military or any other method to have access to vote in their elections here at home. And the counties would, I think, appropriately support 16.21C as written, and thank the secretary for trying to come up with a method for these voters to participate, because their participation rates are much lower than the rest of the voting population generally. So with that, thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Turn that back on. Are there questions for Mr. Reynolds? I have one for you. So in 7.7.1, which is the missing signature issue, mm-hmm. So if we have a voter who forgot to sign, they're sent the notice, and on the eighth cure day, because people wait to the last minute at times, mm-hmm. they submit their signature, but the signature doesn't match. What would happen in that circumstance to that voter's ability to vote?
So, and I can't, offhand, I don't recall an issue like that happening, at least in our county. I don't know if there's others. I mean, I can certainly go back to the committee and ask if that issue has come up. My experience generally is that the majority of our mail ballots that ultimately end up in CURE are missing signatures. We've done some things to redesign the ballot and make it more obvious to for where voters need to sign, so we've seen that decrease. But of those people that forget to sign, they're also the highest percentage that actually CURE. So they return the affidavit, they sign, we do signature verification on the affidavit, and their, you know, ballots normally ultimately get accepted. I can go back and ask ESRC if anyone has experienced that issue. We would probably contact them via email or phone right away and ask for, you know, them to send over a copy of ID if it was considered a discrepancy then. But I think based on Clerk Martin's comments earlier and what we've talked about at the ESRC level, we don't want to put an additional, I mean, in a way we're putting an additional burden on these particular voters for missing the signature line or what have you. We're treating them as if they're discrepant when they haven't been yet deemed that way. And so I think that was mainly the concern from an operational perspective, how we would facilitate that and make sure that these voters do get cured.
And I would appreciate you doing that. You know, we know from our study that somewhere between, give or take a little bit, about a small percentage of signatures are discrepant. Mm-hmm. And what I would hate to have happen is someone gets the first letter that says, you forgot to sign, and then they get a second letter sent out that says, and the one you sent in doesn't match, and, oh, by the way, you get this letter, you know, we sent it out on the seventh day, after the election, they get it on the eighth day, and when they get home from work, and it's after 5 o'clock, and they lost their opportunity. So I recognize that's a small percentage, since most signatures do match, but it is a concern that I have, wanting to ensure that we're not going back to that same voter a second time and saying, send us something else. So that's, I'd appreciate you visiting with the ESRC, by the way, which stands for?
Election Statute Review Committee.
Thank you.
But yeah, no, I'll go back and see if that actually has come up, because I'm not aware of it happening in Denver, but yeah, it could have elsewhere.
So. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate Thank it. You. Takes care of the first two pages. I go to a third page. Steve, do we have any others here? Okay. So this is our last individual. What?
More the point at me, so if you need to sign in.
Just okay, if you want to sign in, you need to do it now, please, is what I'm asking for. Next individual is Marilyn Marks, representing herself. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Marks.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for offering the public a chance to comment on this. My name is Marilyn Marks, and as you said, I'm just representing myself today. I will plan to offer some written comments on a number of subjects later this week. But for today, for the most part, I'm going to limit my comments to two topics, email voting and the mail ballot collection documentation. I had not planned to say anything today on signature. And if you've gotten a few comments from the clerks on signature rules or signature verification rules. A thought, although it's not covered in the rules, I've actually run into a lot of voters who are not aware that their signature is actually supposed to match the voter registration files. And you can imagine that people might not realize what it's being compared to. You might consider in the instructions that go out with the ballots that you remind people that their signature needs to match what's on their voter registration files. Like, for example, I probably signed my voter registration file some years ago, Marilyn R. Marks, but now my normal signature is M.R. Marks. So people probably need to think about that, perhaps just a instruction.
I wonder whether that would cause more confusion for the voter who then goes, well, what does it look like, and how do I make sure it matches, because which one are they looking at? So
okay,
well, we'll look at that, but thank you.
May need to know that it needs to match something. okay. Also, you would ask us not to be repetitive in our comments. So I would like to say that I want to echo the comments of Senator Laura Woods on the topics of proposed email voting rules, as well as I want to add the current practice of UOCAVA votes. And I believe that the current practice and the rules are contrary to the clear legislative intent and also exceed the authority of your office for the very reasons that Senator Woods articulated. I would also like to echo the comments of Elena Nunez of Common Cause on the definition of internet voting and also her comments on feasibility. As I say, I don't believe that the rules on email voting, internet voting, are authorized by statute or legislative history. While your office gave a response to some of our comments about the rules being contrary to the 2006 history, where this notion of feasibility and electronic transmission was first put into statute, and I think your office said, hey, look, no, there was a clean slate, essentially, in 2011 because there was new legislation that authorized this and authorized the secretary to promulgate rules in 2011, and that was House Bill 1219. I urge you to go through and listen to the legislative hearings that took place at that time. And I think what you'll find is that there was consistent reference to the restrictions that were in the legislative history in 2006. It was very clear from Representative Levy, who was one of the sponsors, that there was not to be any expansion on the idea of electronic transmission of voted ballots. She, in fact, made the point that they wanted to make sure that the ballots could get there in a way that they could be returned by postal mail because there were privacy concerns otherwise. She made it a point to say that the focus was on the mail ballot return and that electronic return was a separate issue, they were not attempting to take that up in that Bill 1219. Secretary Gessler at that time came to the hearing and said that electronic transmission that the secretary was promoting was going to be for electronic transmission of ballots only to the voter. He went on to say that the military voters needed to be overseas in order to receive such ballots, and that there would be a secure system where they could receive unvoted ballots, but went on to say that the secretary would not allow the return of voted ballots by the internet or on email. He noted, he called it filled out ballots. We will not receive filled out ballots, he says. He said that the voter would have 53 days to fill out a ballot and send it back by mail. So he was clearly promoting the idea that email ballots should never be returned, it's voted ballots, unless there were unusual circumstances. Representative Levy also said, we are not broadening what is allowed in electronic transmission. Senator Newell, who was also a sponsor, talked about the Amendment L007 that came into that bill. And what that did was to pick up the language from the 2006 restriction of feasibility and that the secretary was to promulgate rules. And I believe, Mr. Secretary, you were at that hearing at that time. And I believe you spoke up and said that that amendment was indeed an appropriate amendment. And she made it clear that the return of a voted ballot by electronic transmission should only be for extenuating circumstances. She said, we want to make it easy to vote, but we do not want to minimize the security. And she said it should be the exception rather than the rule. Senator Newell went on to say that electronic transmission of voted ballots is of concern, and she says, we know that email is easily hacked. She talked about the online receipt of ballots to a server in a clerk's office, and she says we are restricting this as much as possible in L007. So I don't think that there is any way that House Bill 1219 can be read to allow any kind of broadening of the very restrictive 2006 legislative intent to narrow this to what was then called by the Secretary's office a handful of voters every election cycle, where postal mail and telephonic fax was unavailable. The very idea that each voter should decide for himself what is more secure or feasible certainly invites abuse and a higher risk of electronic manipulation and hacking. And it's very bad public policy to permit voters to waive their rights to privacy in circumstances where it's not truly necessary, and it violates the spirit of our privacy laws. I also wanted to comment on the current system of online ballot marking. When a voter inputs his choices on a third-party commercial online ballot marking system, he is sharing his voted ballot with an unauthorized third-party vendor. It likely violates the criminal statutes that prevent a voter from disclosing his vote to anyone other than a judge who's authorized to be assisting the voter in voting. On Rule 7.2.6, it's been stricken, I suppose, in these rules, where it was educating the voter as well as asking the voter to sign that they're voluntarily giving their ballot to a third party and that they've marked and sealed their ballot in private and have not allowed any person to observe the marking of the ballot except for those authorized to assist in voters under the state or federal law. I would encourage that absolutely needs to be put into the rules, put on the envelope. This language is no different than the well-used in all 50 states federal write-in absentee ballot language. It is the current language that's on the UOCAVA attestation. And although Clerk Martin stood up here and said that this using this kind of language would create all sorts of confusion by the clerks, you get thousands of ballots today with that very language on the affidavit. So I don't think it's confusing. And I encourage you to do this so that voters will be reminded that, in fact, they are to mark their ballot in private. They are not to show it to anyone else. And certainly, there are people who attempt to coerce others to have their ballot shown, to mark their ballot in groups. And while it may be difficult to enforce this, we know it would be very difficult to enforce, we ought to ask the voters to sign this, acknowledge it, just as we do with our UOCAVA voters. Thank you for taking my comments.
Other questions for Ms. Marks? Ms. Marks, please remain, if you would, please. Okay. As long as you're willing to answer a couple
sure,
of questions.
Sure, I'll try.
So, with respect to the last point, is it your belief that it is, that it should be a violation of the law for a couple to sit down at the kitchen table and fill out their ballots together?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I mean, should it be a violation or is it a violation?
Should it be?
Yes.
And then with respect to your comments on item 16, I think you said it shouldn't be the service member who should make on Rule 16.2.1C. Somebody's go a little fast, excuse me. Is it your belief, if not the service member, then who should make that call as to whether that was an appropriately submitted ballot via electronic transmission?
Okay. You're saying whether or not it was feasible to...
Who makes that call?
Okay. I believe that it's going to differ by circumstance, I believe. But if we tell the voter a specified period of time and say, if you're in a circumstance that you can't get your ballot in and whatever it might be, I'm just using an example, 30 days. If you don't think your mail service will do it in 30 days, sign that you don't think that it will, you know, and use the standard 30 days. But I would say that that is primarily for your civilian overseas voters. What I would recommend doing to make the decision-making easier on the voter and on the clerk for military is to have the voting officer, most of them will have a voting officer, sign it was not feasible from this location to mail the ballot by postal mail.
Okay. And then do you believe that returning ballots by mail is a secure method?
Well, because I think this, you know what I believe, that people should be in the precinct polling places if at all possible. But no, mail is not 100% secure, but it is certainly far more secure than email voting. It's not perfect, but it's a heck of a lot better than email. And I think that that is why we have legislative history that is so clear to say if there's postal mail in any it all available, use it and don't run the risk of the high, you know, highly hackable email system.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Next individual who signed up, and again, is there anyone here who wishes to sign up who has not yet done so? Okay, Ms. Everly, if you would come forward. Our next one is Mary Everly, who is representing herself.
Thank you, Secretary Williams. I think the first rule that you, Secretary Williams, should have promulgated is that the Starbucks downstairs could not close until the new coffee facility was up and running.
I appreciate that input. That might be outside the scope of my authority.
I thought
I
you might say that.
I would agree with the Senator on that one.
Well, I'll get serious. The mail ballot voter needs to be assured that the law supports absolute secrecy in voting. And thus, Rule 7.2.6 needs modification. Also, the citizens want the rules to mirror the law on internet voting, which means voting that uses the internet. Thus, Rule 16 needs some modification. I wasn't going to speak about 7.7.1, but since you've asked a couple of people about whether the ID copy was needed when a person was carrying a missing signature. And I like the belt and suspenders approach so that that vote is most likely to be counted. And as you point out, there are many ways to get a copy to the clerk. I agree with what Marilyn Marks just said about 7.2.6. I think that the original language is very good. It should not be taken away. I think the new proposed language is somewhat unclear because it sounds almost like everybody is going to be voluntarily giving up their envelope with their ballot, and that's probably not what was intended. Let's see. Moving on to Rule 16. And I may be wrong about this, but the current rule, 16.1.5, that's being repealed, I think is a good rule because it gives the time frame for mailing back the ballot that has to be before 7 o'clock in the evening on Election Day. And and if ballots are sent back electronically, they should be that send button on the email should be clicked before 7 o'clock on Election Day. And obviously there needs to be a separate sentence that mail ballots must be received within the 8-day period after Election Day, because the electronic return certainly is going to be much faster, and we don't want to have people sending their ballots back with the spoofed date electronically 5 days after Election Day. That would just not be good. So that needs some clarification and repositioning in the rules list. Let's see. 16.2.1 parentheses C has had a lot of discussion. I think one of the problems is the word believes. I think that we need to be giving the voter as much information as possible. I've seen a list that's available through FVAP, F-V-A-P, Federal Voting Assistance Program, I think, that lists different countries and how long it takes to get ballots back from them. Well, that resource could be given to UOCAPA voters to check and see if it's within their power to use that 53 days to get their ballot back. I think maybe they don't have good guidance right now, and that could be improved. Also, I just, if you won't mind, like to read a definition of not feasible that was proposed when House Bill 15-10-11 was being discussed in the legislature. It wasn't added, but this was a pretty good definition. Not feasible refers to circumstances where voting in person or by regular or expedited mail is impossible because a covered military voter is out of state or a covered overseas voter is out of the country. An expedited or postal mail is unavailable to the covered voter for mail ballot return in time for the ballot to reach the clerk by the close of business on the eighth day after an election. There are several important additions in this definition. It specifies the military voters out of state. That isn't mentioned very often, and a military voter within our state's boundaries is not supposed to be using these methods. Also, overseas voter, as one of my friends has many times said, people on the Florida Keys are overseas, aren't they? And people in Hawaii are overseas, and maybe on the Aleutian Islands, those are overseas too. So what we really need to emphasize is out of the country. So we get those people in Canada who are not overseas, but they are, sort of. So we need some clarification. Also, on parentheses D in that same rule, it says to return a voted ballot and self-affirmation by email, the elector must scan and return the documents as an email attachment. So I have heard that sometimes that is not the method used, and I'm very concerned about that and would like the clerks to be instructed not to allow any other method, and in other words, not to allow any web-based method to return a ballot. On rule 16.2.2, parentheses G, parentheses 4, it says the self-affirmation required by section 1-8.3-114 CRS and rule 16.2.3. This is something that has to be in the mail ballot packet. Well, the rule 16.2.3 is really inadequate. It mentions just a sort of a laundry list of things the voter has to supply. What's on the affidavit right now is, and I guess because of time I won't read the whole thing, you know what's on it, but it does say, I am a member of the Uniformed Services or Merchant Marine on active duty, but it doesn't say, and I am out of the state of Colorado. It's things like that we need to tighten these things up and be sure that the voter has the best chance to make the decision that voting early in the 53-day period and using postal or expedited mail, the military has free expedited mail, unless they're on a submarine or scientists at the South Pole in the winter or astronauts, but most military anyway have expedited mail. Give them the chance to make that choice because they become educated as to the requirements. They have to be out of state or out of the country, depending. And they understand that the state is concerned about the dangers of to the election of electronic return. And let's see, I'll probably write you some more about that. And I agree with Margaret Johansson and Elena Nunez about Rule 16.2.8. And as far as the commission goes, I think it's a great idea. And I appreciate Secretary Williams that you're going to devote resources to keeping this kind of dialogue going. But I have a concern about 23.1.2 parentheses A parentheses 7. It says, this is on the membership of the commission, two members with expertise on voting rights and or election integrity. Now, I read that as people who are not clerks or legislators or in any of these government categories. In other words, regular citizens. And I would like to suggest everything else, you know, seems fine, but why don't we boost that number so that there are as many citizens who are not part of the government in any category as there are people who are part of the government. So in other words, we'd have at least 10 citizens. And if you're going to have a chair that isn't that will be part of the committee, then we need it to be 11. So those are my comments. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Mr. Trout.
Mary, this is Judd. I think you might have an older version of the rules. Do you have, at the bottom of your rules, does it say the date at which they were adopted and effective? You quote 16.2.3. I think you quote an older version of 16.2.3.
I don't think I, did I quote it?
Well, you cited it and
I mentioned it, yes, because yeah. You're adding to it, are you not?
Yes. The proposed rules add to 16.2.3.
I don't have, the printouts I have don't have the date, I'm sorry. Okay. But it came from the rules that were adopted in place during last fall's election. Aren't those the current rules?
Yeah, the 9, 10,
yeah.
And the other thing I was going to mention is that yes, there is a 53-day window, but you always have to remember that the 53-day window for Yocaba voters both includes the mail going out and the mail coming back. So there's not just, so the voter themselves does not have 53 days. If it takes 20 days for the mail to get to the voter, then, and you can anticipate that it's going to take 20 days for the mail to leave after the voter mails it, then they themselves have to know that they are they have far less than 53 days. So, but feel free to.
Judd, thank you for that. But I think that for a person to return their voted ballot electronically, they have to have received it electronically. So that should have been pretty instant. So there wouldn't be that 20-day lead time in the 53-day period. They'd have the full 53 days. No?
Well, I'm going to your point about there are other ways that you could return a ballot. You could return a ballot by voting a hard copy ballot that you received in the mail and then returning that hard copy ballot in the mail. But you would lose the time in which the ballot was in the mail prior to you receiving it, and then you would lose the time that it then entered the mail stream and returned back to your jurisdiction. So there's a far fewer than 53 days if you were going to use the traditional way of getting your ballot by hard copy mail and then returning it by hard copy mail. So I'm just making the point that 53 days is the absolute maximum amount of time that you could potentially have. But for many voters, it's far less than 53 days.
Well, I appreciate that comment, and I will look up the requirement that I believe exists that to return a voted ballot electronically, you have to have made arrangements for that ahead of time.
Okay. So, Dwight had a
fight. I think I can. Hi, this is Dwight Shulman. I'm the county support manager for the state elections division. I'd like to give you just a very common example of how this happened. If you assume that a overseas or military voter initially requested a ballot by mail, and then 5 or 6 days before the election, they realize they haven't received that ballot, they then request an electronic ballot to be delivered to them. So in that, and that's completely permissible, and in that circumstance, that voter obviously would have far fewer than 53 days to return the ballot, and that's a very common occurrence. So that's how that can happen.
Thank you, Dwight.
Let me ask one question if I could. So you talked about providing information to the voters, and the proposed rules add a phrase in 16.2.3 for the first time that would actually let the voter know that Colorado law requires that I return the ballot by a more secure method, such as mail, if available and feasible, which has not been in the rules previously. And so voters were not told of this requirement. Do you believe that adding this requirement is appropriate?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your participation here today.
Thank you.
Are there any other individuals that wish to sign up? This is not a speak now or forever hold your peace. We will continue the opportunity for public comment through next Tuesday at 5 p.m. And so that will be, so I try and do math in my head, Tuesday, July 14th, 2015 at 5 p.m. And we encourage you, if you heard things today that you wish to provide specific guidance on, or if you agree with or disagree with something, you are welcome to let us know that. I appreciate each of you who took the opportunity to come here today. And recognize that each of you have given of your time to be here, and I want to say thank you for your input. At this time, our office will take under advisement possible amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. We will continue to do that. As I indicated, the record will remain open through 5 p.m. Tuesday, July 14th, to allow the submission of additional written comments by people who are here or people who are not here. So a pretty wide variety of folks. This concludes today's hearing. Since that clock is not fully accurate, according to my clock, it is 3:09 p.m. and the hearing is concluded, although the public comment period will remain open as stated previously. Any other things that we need to cover at the hearing? Okay, thank you very much. The hearing is closed.